Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Leslie Garvin. I'm the Vice Chair of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley Advisory Council. At this time, we would like to acknowledge and thank Microsoft, Fleischmann Hillard, and the Harvard Club for supporting tonight's program. We would also like to welcome our Commonwealth Club members and encourage those of you who are not members to join, as your membership helps support nearly 100 events held each year in Silicon Valley. It is my pleasure to introduce tonight's moderator, John Fort, senior writer for Fortune. John joined Fortune in 2007. He reports on technology and innovation in Silicon Valley and has written for Business 2.0 and the San Jose Mercury News. Ladies and gentlemen, John Fort.
Good evening, everybody. I'm thrilled to be here with this great panel to talk about a topic that spends a lot of time on my mind, which is mobile. When I look out at the technology landscape, I find mobile to be the most fascinating area, because if you had told me 10 years ago that in Silicon Valley right now, we'd be dealing with a situation where Apple has 40 million of these devices with this exciting new platform, and they're kind of thought leaders in this space, I'd have said, huh? And probably a lot of people on this campus would have said, huh? But it's so wide open right now because it's so early. Microsoft is doing a lot of things. Google is doing a lot of things. Apple, obviously, RIM, so many players. And we've got a lot of people on this panel who represent different ways of looking at mobile. So hope to probe them for their thoughts. So please do start writing down your questions. Let me first introduce the panel. On my far right, on this side, we have Peter Hadi, the co-founder of Kinoma. Next to him, we have Arun Bikshasvaran, Senior Vice President of Multimedia and Infrastructure Solutions for Ericsson. Directly to my right, we have Glenn Lurie, President of the Emerging Devices Organization at AT&T. To my left, Ali Dieb, the VP of Product Management and Business Operations at AdMob. Then Tim Attinger, Global Head of Product Development at Visa, and Alan Rambam, President of Mobile Behavior. So my first question, it's 60 seconds to each one of you, right? Describe what it is that you do as it impacts the mobile space. Seriously, 60 seconds. I'm going to time you. I've got my mobile device right here. Start with Peter.
60 seconds or 140 characters, your choice. Peter Hadi with Kinoma. We are a seven-year-old Silicon Valley software company focusing on mobile. We've made the leading media player software for Palm OS for years and years and years and years. We make a product now called Kinoma Play on Windows Mobile, which is an incredibly cool social media browser. It defies description, so go check out Kinoma.com. But it even makes like the iPhone users sometimes drool, which is like saying something. It's available on Windows Mobile today, coming to S60 soon. And Android after that, with a little bit of luck. I'm willing to bet I'm the only person on this panel who still writes code every day, which gives me a little bit of a different perspective.
Somebody, 41 seconds. Very good. Okay.
Okay. So, Arun Bikshasvaran, Ericsson is a company that is operating in the mobile network space, providing infrastructure to pretty much all the carriers in this country, building out networks with 2G, 3G, and 4G technologies. You talked about 10 years ago. Would you have thought about this? We were building networks 20 years ago in the U.S., and we had absolutely no idea this is where we would end up. It is indeed a great thing that is happening here, and we're happy to be part of it.
27, that's beautiful. Glenn.
My name is Glenn Lurie with AT&T, and I do not write code ever. So let's be clear. I am the president of Emerging Devices. I spend most of my time, for those of you who have in your pocket a smartphone or a regular handset, I don't worry much about those. I spend my time worrying about wirelessly enabling everything else in your world. So whether you're talking about your car, or we're talking about your ebook, or we're talking about your netbook, we're talking about your dog collar. We can laugh about that, but I'm going to sell you one. So that's what we're at. The Emerging Device Group is focused around driving all the innovation around other devices. I also have a side job, which I manage the Apple relationship for AT&T. And 10 years ago, I thought the bag phone was pretty cool. So the world's changed a lot.
All right, 48.
I'm Ali. I work for AdMob. We make tools and products that enable app developers and publishers to make money. And I do code, and I'm teaching myself Lua, which is an animation scripting language, as we speak.
Ooh. Wow. 13 wow. seconds.
I don't like my chances of getting under that number.
Don't even try.
I'm Tim Attinger. I work for a company called Visa. And interestingly, as we look at sort of the way mobile can really catalyze the business model for Visa, we're one of the first real network businesses, 50 years old now, and founded in California, so a true barrier startup with a recent IPO. At present, we've got maybe 1.7, 1.8 distributed payment devices in the world, 30 million merchants connected. Moving about $4 to $4.5 trillion every year. But certainly as we look at the opportunity to grow participation in that business model, one of the great ways to get new people onto the system is mobiles. There are nearly one Visa card for every four people on the planet. Mobiles are at one for every two and going north of that. So
how many of them are overdrawn?
Huh? How many of those mobiles are? You laugh. Actually, our primary business is debit cards and prepaid cards. It's the vast majority of our business. So looking at ways to partner with the ecosystem is certainly what I spend a lot of time on.
I interrupted him, and he still came in at 59 seconds. All right, Alan.
All right, there you go. Wow. Got you tons of room.
I know. I got a lot of room. Alan Rambam, and I'm with a company called Mobile Behavior. We're a Fleischmann Hillard managed but Omnicom-owned mobile agency. We're what's called a common asset across Omnicom. So our role is we start with the behavioral piece, and it's basically how people are using their devices across the globe, and then making sure that Omnicom agencies scale and actually create mobile solutions that our actually consumers will use.
All right. 28 seconds. You guys are wonderful. Nice. I can tell this is going to be a great panel. So so my first question, I'm going to direct it to Tim first, but I want to ask everybody,
okay,
is this. So we've had smartphones for a long time. Microsoft has had Windows Mobile for quite a while. Palm had the Palm OS beginning of the decade. But all of a sudden, over the past couple years, the folks at Apple would say it's because of the iPhone, but I don't know. Things have changed. We weren't having the same kind of conversation 3 years ago as we're having now. What changed, and how did it change your business?
I think one of the key changes has been a couple of things. One, we actually got phones. Those smartphones had some pretty broad distribution, right? So they came up with some really great application sets that sort of drove them into much more of an essential component of consumers' lives. But I think the second big piece, which is obviously something that has really driven our interest in those devices, is essentially opening up those platforms to outside development. So the ability to essentially, as we look at knitting together financial services and mobile services in, you know, sort of a complementary catalyst for ecosystems, we've been opening up access to our network and basically, you know, sort of creating programmable layers, web services development layers on the edge of our network to make it easy for people to interact with us. Mobile platform providers have been doing the same thing, and smartphones have been leading the way with that. Symbian, open platform. Android, open platform. You know, Apple's iPhone platform absolutely has, you know, very democratic developer approach. So I think the combination of distribution of those devices and then access to SDKs so that you can start writing to those devices has really driven a catalytic effect.
Some people would say democratic in the North Korea sense, as far as how they manage their...
Yeah, it's like it's the best form of government if you look at all the other forms that have been tried and haven't, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think people, the same people writing the press releases too. Okay. Alan, what changed and how did it affect your business?
Well, I think three things changed. I think number one, bandwidth became much more ubiquitous at a high speed and in an affordable way. I mean, you have sort of unlimited data rate plans thanks to guys like Glenn and AT&T. So I think that was a very big catalyst initially. Secondly, I think the iPhone did change things in the sense that it's a platform that people want to develop for. It's, I mean, with all due respect to you know, Microsoft and Windows Mobile. I worked at Microsoft before. I don't think it was a platform that was as sort of developer-friendly as the iPhone has become. So from a user experience standpoint and from a tools standpoint, I think that really changed the game, and I think it forced a lot of people to think differently about these devices in terms of them being more like computers versus phones. And I think the last thing that it might be sort of an indirect impact is I think the success of the web and the business models of the web, whether it's ad-based monetization or other kinds of monetization models, has now started as a result of those first two trends to migrate over to mobile. And I think that that's causing a lot of innovation from a development standpoint, an application development standpoint, and services development standpoint specifically, that didn't occur 5 or 6 years ago.
Okay. Alan?
Yeah, I'm going to jump off of what Ali said and just, I think it is. It's the mobile's the link between sort of in real life and the web. And I think that that social piece, and that's one thing we forget, is that the PC by many standards was created for business and by business, and the mobile device has always been about socialization. And all of the, I think, the coming together of all the social aspects of the social networks and the one clicks and just how easy that's been, and of course the iPhone and the other devices that have enabled that from an application perspective, but even on a simple, at the end of the day, Twitter is SMS. So at the end of the day, just those really simple platforms to bring people together through socialization, especially I work on the youth side, which is, for them, they're sort of a mobile-first generation, so it's all about socialization. So I think that's definitely a key thing that's come together.
Great. Okay. Peter, you've been in mobile for a long time. You're probably wondering what took everybody so long. What changed?
Yeah, I mean, when we started Kinoma, we made a conscious decision to focus on what then was becoming the smartphone segment, which was like the Palm 5 was like our kind of like marquee platform, and everyone said you're insane to do mobile software on there, but it's served us well as kind of the smartphone devices have become mainstream because we had a clean start versus being kind of tied to all kind of the old world of everything's written to the operator spec. With no offense to Glenn, but that freedom that the iPhone brought and that Palm brought, really, I mean, the Palm OS was really the first
Glenn
place where that flourished, where people could try ideas without having to do a deployment with the carrier at, you know, tens of millions of units at a time, let you try out ideas and see what worked and what doesn't. You know, we do deals with operators and carriers like Palm and SoftBank and Docomo, and those things have got to be, I mean, rock solid, perfectly, you know, operating well, thought out. We also have a retail product, and we get to try things there, and that's fun, right? We hear from our users on Twitter if it's great or not, and we can release an update the next day to take care of that. And that gives us this cycle that lets us build up knowledge and experience and tune a user interface, which is something that's very hard to do, kind of sitting on your own. You get too close to something, right? So the cycle time has come way down. It really increases kind of creativity of like what the offerings are that you can put out there. So I think it's been a really good thing. Bandwidth, just a couple people have said, oh, there's lots of bandwidth. We do digital media, audio streaming, video, pictures. I've never been in a meeting with somebody from a mobile operator who doesn't say, we're very concerned about the bandwidth on our network. No matter how good the network is, no matter how much capacity they have, no matter what their television commercials say, they're always very concerned.
We're very concerned.
So it's I don't think that problem's going away, and you know, I think everybody's hoping Wi-Fi will kind of help smooth some of those bumps out.
Yeah, I think everybody is hoping that. Aaron?
Well, you know, smartphones have given us a purpose in life. That's what I would say. You know, because what really happened was, you know, we had a solution and we were looking for a problem. We had technology that could deliver, you know, multi-megabits in mobile environments, and we were sitting around waiting for something to come use all that bandwidth. And I think that is a dramatic change that we have seen. It is, you know, AT&T pushed us to develop some new technology. They continue to push us, and other carriers have, you know, kind of gotten wind of this now. And that's what we want to do. We want to innovate, and we want to bring, you know, high-speed mobile data to everybody and, you know, let people use it.
Okay. Last but not least, Glenn.
Wow, these guys all had really smart answers. No, I'll say this. I'll take a little different tack. What changed is all of you. You know, customers changed. If you think back 3 years ago, and just think back three holiday seasons ago, was the first holiday season that we pushed smartphones and went after consumers. Before that, what was a smartphone? It was a business device, right? It was a RIM. It was email. That's what it did. So 3 years ago, we crossed that bridge. What's happened? Okay, for those of you in the room that have teenagers, and there are some teenagers in the room, any teenager you know want anything but a QWERTY device. Why? Because SMS is what they do. Okay, that's how they live their lives now. Right? I've got a 13-year-old daughter who does 4,000 SMSs a month and uses about 20 minutes of voice.
Hope you have a really good wireless plan.
I have a very good wireless plan. But my point is that consumers changed. And our country as a whole, is how people viewed what they use that device for changed. Apple gets a lot of credit, but this happened before Apple. And one of the hottest things we have right now, if you see our ads and see what we're pushing, we have these messaging devices. Okay, they're not really smart OSs. They do surf, but they're really made for what? They're made for kids to do the social networking and the SMS, and we're selling them like hotcakes. So what really changed was really the United States public, and they changed their perception of what they wanted and what they wanted to have and what that perception would be. Also, I think it was said earlier, the youth market has completely taken over this space. That's my future customer. That's who we need to look at, who we talk to and we get feedback from, and they will not carry anything but a smartphone. And that's the future.
Now, I heard a lot just now about data. And so I kind of want to take a sharp turn here, because I think voice is actually changing quite a bit too. A couple of ventures that are based here in Silicon Valley that are convincing me of that is, one's called 3Jam, another is Google Voice. And I don't know, are there any folks out here who use either 3Jam or Google Voice?
Wow.
Wow.
Silicon Valley.
I've been using Google Voice since it was Grand Central, and I take it you are all probably fans. It's totally changed my voice experience, because it's this phone number that sort of lives on the internet that I can make ring anywhere. My voicemails live in the cloud. It's like a phone, except it's not the device. And you know, I got in early with this thing, so I still have the app on here, even though, you know, Apple just yanked it. But I'm wondering what everybody thinks about the changes happening in voice, because that's still the killer app for phones in most of the world. Is voice an interesting space for innovation, or is it just all about data?
Can I start?
Sure. Yeah.
So, you know, we had a quick chat about this. Voice is interesting, but where voice is going in terms of adding on other multimedia content is where it is most interesting. I agree with you, having the number in the cloud and having it go to different destinations, yeah, okay, it's kind of cool. But really, at the end of the day, you know, I have this phone, it does video sharing, so I can have a video sharing session with my 5-year-old daughter. I was telling these guys, I got her a phone like this just about a week ago, and today she's called me twice on this phone to share what she's doing back at home. Now, that is a completely unique experience, possible only with mobile phones. It captures the context precisely, and it delivers a unique experience. So that is where I think voice is going to grow with richer experiences, and that is what I look forward to.
Yeah, I'll take that. I mean, that's voice with the added app of video kind of layered on top of it, one could say. Anybody else want to take that?
Sure. I didn't realize you can still call people on the phone.
Not all the time, not reliably, but you can. Absolutely.
I thought SMS was the killer app.
Yeah.
I know for us on the youth side, it's the, you know, it started with a LifeCast, it's now a LifeStream, and a video and products like video share. We talked about Quick earlier, QIK, that allows you to in real time basically send video and send it right to your Facebook page, right to other things. I mean, I think that's really the. I think I agree with you. It's the LifeStream. And where does voice play a role in that? But I do think that SMS is kind of the killer app.
Well, and if I'd just add, I mean, interesting things we're seeing, again, outside of North America, where, you know, sort of basic mobile functionality is a 2G device, and I use it for calls and SMS. We just launched a service in Peru where a consumer sitting in the back of the cab can call. I mean, again, back to your number in the cloud concept, we actually have account numbers that live in the cloud behind our firewall, and a consumer calls in and says, I want to pay this guy. Here's his number. And please affect that. They get an IVR callback. They enter a PIN. And then essentially the cab driver who's sitting in the front of the cab gets paid. It's all voice-based. Mm-hmm. Right? Again, doesn't sound sexy, but it uses the existing ubiquitous infrastructure and enables commerce where it otherwise wouldn't occur. So absolutely, I think voice is still interesting.
Mm. Can I say something on this that's slightly different?
You guys are all on the panel. You can say something at almost any time. Yeah.
So I use Google Voice. Sorry, Glenn. And I don't use it because of the voice features. I use it because it's more like a personal domain name server. So if somebody wants to reach me, there's just one way to reach me, and it's kind of like what UM or Unified Messaging sort of promised, you know, a decade ago but never really fulfilled on. And I think, you know, with regard to voice and your comment about why we're so focused on data, I mean, I think the economics sort of tell a story, which is, you know, the vast majority of the growth and value, at least on mobile and elsewhere, is in the data part of the stack, not in the voice part of the stack. And I personally don't think that that's going to change. I mean, the fixed line world is a nice sort of precursor to what's happening in the mobile world, I think, and it's clearly happening there. So we're obviously focused much more on the data side of things because that's what we do, but I think the economics sort of bears that out.
Well, let me bend this into a kind of current newsy question. There's been a bit of controversy lately about Google Voice and AT&T and Apple because, as you might have seen, Google was making a Google Voice app for the iPhone. They submitted it, waited 6 weeks, and got the word, no, not so much, you can't release that. And folks wondered, was it Apple that did the rejection or was it AT&T? Glenn?
That's a direct question.
Did you kill Google Voice, Glenn?
So John knows what I'm going to say here, right?
I do.
Yeah, no comment. No, I really, right now, obviously, there's lots going on here. I don't have a comment. All I'll say is this, is, you know, obviously we've got great relationships with Google and we have great relationships with Apple, and we all do business together in different ways. But in this specific topic, I can't make comment.
And I understand that. I just, for my own integrity's sake,
you gave me a hard time, didn't you?
Yeah, okay. I did. But I have another question that you can't answer.
Okay, good.
Services like Google Voice and 3G. How does AT&T feel about those? Because, I mean, it actually does use voice minutes, unlike, you know.
So let me take a different spin. And, you know, and as Ali said, I think it's great that people are using these. These are – the key spin I'll take is about innovation. Okay, so we just said, what do you think this was going to be 5 years ago, 10 years ago, three? You know, what do you think 10 minutes ago was going to be new? And this is all new. And what customers want, if people start to look at that as a great way to have, as you said, a single place to go, the cloud, we better learn something from that. Whether we're going to compete with it, whether it's going to be part of our offering or not. As a carrier like us, you know, we're a $130 billion company, and we've got, you know, millions and millions of customers. We better listen to our customers. And the thing I like about what's happening with some of these new services is we're learning. Mm-hmm. Do you want that mobile? Do you want it on your landline? Obviously, you all know the landline business is a declining business. You know, so the voice question, which I didn't get asked, you know, voice is obviously still a killer app. Voice is still a key to what we do, but voice is moving from fixed line to mobile, because obviously the fixed line, how many people still have home phones? And if you're in, you know, gee, that's shocking. And I'm glad, keep it. But anybody who's under 21 years old will never have a home phone, right? I mean, they're going to be, it's all going to be on mobile. So obviously, when we look at all of this as positive, it's the industry is so phenomenal when you think about what's happened from an innovation perspective. And if we're a smart company, we'll watch all these things and say, okay, how do we want to play in those? And if our customers want that, we better go figure out a way to deliver it, or guess what? We'll lose customers.
I just want to quickly remind everybody, get your questions written down, and then we'll get to those later in the session. So don't delay in writing those questions down. Peter?
Yeah, I mean, I can touch the third rail that Glenn's not allowed anywhere near. I have no insight into, like, what happened inside Apple and AT&T and Google. But there's a couple things going on here. One is this monopoly that's not yet called a monopoly of the iPhone environment is this bizarre world. As a developer, why don't I have an iPhone app? Well, because unlike Google, I can't afford to have like a dozen engineers work for a year to build an app to then go plead at the gate in Cupertino, please, please let me on your phone. I go somewhere else. And people should go somewhere else if that doesn't work for them. And, you know, to AT&T, I have no idea if they're involved or not, but a lot of this goes back to, I mean, if some of you remember a company called AOL, and then the internet came along, they had this walled garden thing that was really cool, and they didn't like the internet because it kind of messed with their business model. Like, set my data free. Like, it's my data, let me get it and do what I want with it. I'll pay you for it, for that access to that data, just like I do in my home when I want to, like, access cable, you know, my cable modem. But this idea that, oh, the carrier, the person who's providing my bandwidth is going to decide what services I get over it, it gets, like, a little bit much, and eventually it will go away. And, you know, as you said, Glenn, when the customers demand it, that's what will happen. And I believe AT&T will change when the time is right. But it's a matter of people getting annoyed with this and talking about it and doing something about it. And that's what's going to change things, not, kind of like just saying it's good enough and the iPhone's kind of cool, so we'll live with it. It doesn't work that way.
Okay, I want to ask an innovation question. What are some of the coolest things, maybe just name one, of the coolest things that you see happening on mobile, either domestically or internationally, just something that's caught your imagination that you think...
Give me two. You can have two. A couple examples, right? One would be sort of, again, an emerging markets versus development market, a developed markets example. Developed market example, I think back to what you were saying, Alan, you know, sort of the mobile is that great link from the cloud, the internet cloud to the physical world. I mean, one of the applications that we've got out now is on the Android device. And again, simply because it was a great opportunity to tie together a partnership with Google. But you have consumers who essentially can go in, search, at the result, at the end of that search, say, okay, I think I'm making a buying decision. At that point, if the consumer's permissioned it, the company they're looking at can say, hey, I'll give you a deal if you come in the next 4 days and use the card that you've registered to this application, I'll automate this benefit back to you. Right. So essentially, it's taking the advertising model and actually driving it down to showing an ROI to the advertiser that there was a transaction that was generated as a result of this. So I think that's a massive transformation. That, quite frankly, you know, the application sets like what Visa Mobile is doing on the Android device, and we plan to do with all the smart platforms because, you know, at the end of the day, we're all about democratization of access to financial services and getting to those customers. We know we have customers out there who will want to have applications like this regardless of the device they're on, so we're working on every one of them. It sort of changes the experience for that advertiser, changes the experience for that customer really quickly. In emerging markets, I mean, one of the biggest innovations we've seen is – again, the example I think we were talking about earlier before the session, 6 blocks off the main road in a Delhi township called Uttam Nagar is a guy who's basically a location of a branch location of the State Bank of India, a distributor of Bharti Airtel services, and establishing Visa accounts in an alleyway. And it's all done via SMS over 2G mobile devices.
So I want you to take a little time and explain that to folks because it's fascinating. You said he's actually a pharmacist.
He's a pharmacist.
But... Through the network.
Uh-huh. So basically he's a pharmacist, and what that means is he's a trusted local businessman that most people come to see on a regular basis. So as a result, he's a distributor of rail tickets. He sells SIM cards and devices for Bharti Airtel. He takes electricity bill payments over the counter, and he also is essentially a branch location of the State Bank of India. And as a result, again, through the wireless device that he has in his pocket and that every single one of his customers has, they're turning what has been a cash gray market economy into something that is seamless, electronified, democratized, and visible to the Indian government in a way that they've never had before.
So basically, he's a browser. I mean, that's really what he is. Without a computer,
it is.
Because of two cell phones, this guy has become an ATM, John.
But he is. I mean, he is to some extent through that simple electronic messaging protocol. He is becoming what would otherwise be a web-based interface into financial services for people who otherwise would never have access to it. I mean, so that kind of thing. I think when you talk about the promise of mobile and particularly voice and data, just those baseline messaging protocols and the ability to enfranchise people who would otherwise be outside of the banking system globally, particularly in emerging markets where growth of mobiles is outstripping growth of bank accounts by 3-to-1, that's absolutely one of the biggest stories and biggest ideas out there.
Those are two very cool things. Who else has thrown an answer?
So I think the most sort of impressive thing to me that's changing right now is something that's not super obvious to consumers and I think is truly seismic. I think the fact that developers now who graduate from top sort of computer science programs around the world, like Stanford, for example, are much more interested in building apps for mobile devices than they are for desktop computers. And I think that shift from sort of the desktop to the mobile being the primary development framework is a really revolutionary thing that I think not a lot of people, a lot of people enjoy it as consumers because they actually have apps to play with on their device, but I don't think a lot of people sort of really feel outside of the valley in certain pockets of the economy. But I mean, for example, at Stanford, my alma mater, CS193, which is an iPhone development class, is by far the most subscribed class for CS undergrads. And I mean, I think that's telling.
I agree with both of you. We actually employ two young people from ITP, the NYU which is the telecommunications program. And it's amazing the caliber of apps and things that are coming out of there. And then we also just we have a site, nextgreatthing.com. We just read about M-Pesa, mm-hmm. which I think is a very similar unique mm-hmm. kind of payment thing. The two things I would say that are, some of the prescriptive social software that's coming out, like Bouillon Foursquare, where you're turning kind of life into a game. I think that is really, from a marketing side, a lot of opportunity there from advertiser kind of integration and open API side.
And that's basically where you might get points for doing stuff in real life and sharing it with people.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. And it's really the opportunity there for marketers to and the other, I guess, is augmented reality, which also is an incredible opportunity for marketers, too. And that's where you're basically adding, like, using mobile to add a physical presence to Zagat's just open their augmented reality where you can actually go in and really feel like you're in a restaurant. And I think being able to do that from your device and the ability then for brick and mortar to, you know, try on to some of the visualization that can happen, I think those are two things from the advertising side that we're going to see a lot of promise over the next kind of 12 to 18 months.
All right, let's toss right.
Anything for...
Go ahead. Go ahead. All right, let's take a device spin on this. These guys over here are way too smart for me. Device spin. How many people in here use a Kindle? Anybody? Okay, so the Kindle
is... more Google Voice than Kindle. That's
I'm going to say. Jeez, you're killing me.
Wow.
So I think one of the neatest concepts that you think about is really where is the device going? First of all, you have a device in your pocket. And I don't think that's going anywhere. I think you're going to continue to see that morph. The iPhone's obviously done well. There's work going on around Android and other things that are going to be very cool. What I think the next device is going to be a 10 or 12-inch screen. It's going to be in your briefcase or your purse, and it's going to carry all the essential reading data that you might want to have for that day. And I think the concept of waking up in the morning and having my Wall Street Journal, my USA Today, and my Fortune magazine, and all the things that I want in a device with me, updated automatically, is a pretty interesting concept. Think about all the ecosystem that falls into that. Think of what's going on in the newspaper world right now, right? Struggling big time, right? Newspapers, magazines are all having a difficult time. Now make that a press of a button. You're not having to put out a paper. It's ending up on these devices. Think about that device being full color. Think about it having your videos on it. Think about it being obviously wirelessly enabled. And start thinking about how the use cases change on a device like that. That, to me, will change what we're all doing again, right? That may change it. And if that device does the things you want, has the capabilities you want, has the memory you want, which we all know it will and can, and all of a sudden, the reason I bring up Kindle is I think you've got to give Amazon some credit. They've done a very nice job, built a very nice model, vertically integrated, simple to use. Customers like it. Now, what's going to happen when you're the pioneer? You're going to take some arrows, and everybody's going to chase you. And all the things that are coming are going to be that vision of what I'm just talking about and what will be inside of your briefcase or purse. Then you start talking about, well, then how does that device interact with the one that's in your pocket? And how do they work together? How do they talk to each other? How does that work? And you start thinking about what those are. To me, that's going to be the next big defining change that we're going to see around devices.
You know, I'm sitting here listening to all this fantastic stuff. And in a very, very technology-oriented way, the single biggest thing that we see is the combination of high-speed mobile data and the internet. We've been developing packet data technologies probably for 20 years. On Bell South, for example, 20 years ago, we had a technology called CDPD, and before that, Mobitex. and you know, for those of you who remember RAM mobile data, it had a small device, QWERTY keyboard.
Yep.
You could send messages. We used it with you guys when we were negotiating. But... But, you know, the internet was not there at that time, and there was no use for that data except for person-to-person messaging. And now, 10, 15 years later, with the internet and high-speed mobile data, that combination is powerful and almost explosive. You see this explosion of devices happening now that you've talked about, you work with every day. All that is enabled by that convergence, and that's at the heart of it, that's what we feel for.
You know, I mean, I think you're absolutely right that the speed is a big deal, and the network is a big chunk of that. but the applications on the phone have a lot that they can contribute to that as well. It's one of the places where you kind of get into this big conceptual debate about, like, is the browser the right place to do everything or applications? And the neat thing about an application is it can have very intelligent caching behavior and pulling data from the cloud ahead of time. So like what Glenn was saying, when you go and you pick that device up, everything that you want to see is already there. You don't have to click and wait, right? The experience on mobile devices is far too often, you know, especially when you're doing stuff on the web, is click and then take your hands off the device, don't touch anything, and wait until it's finished getting that for you, and then it's safe to pick it up and do the next step. And people love the experience where things are just fast. You tap and it responds, and you keep going that way. And so I think an important trend is really away from the browser, where you have very generic caching, where you can't do all these look-aheads, more and more towards applications that are very smart about what data do you want, getting it in advance, having it ready, and holding on to it. And that, coupled with a fast network, can mean that you almost never wait for any of the data that you want to get to regularly.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. I find myself, you know, I'm working at home with my iPhone and my Mac, and my iPhone is sometimes faster than my Mac at pulling up, say, a YouTube video, yep, or, you know, doing any number of things, getting to my email.
Yeah,
so
I love that.
There you go, Glenn. That one's for you.
I feel better now.
Yeah. I want to start getting into some of these questions because we got a lot of good ones and not an unlimited amount of time. And many of these are for specific panelists. So let me do this one first. That's mostly for Tim. The question is, as mobile apps become more pervasive, so will opportunities for creative hackers and stalkers to steal identities, wealth, or worse. How much of your company's attention does that issue receive?
Quite a bit. Because the integrity of our 80 billion transactions is only as good as the next one not being compromised. So we have numbers, multiple layers of security as we look at sort of enabling transactions. And again, financial transactions off of mobile devices. Our favorite way to do that is, you know, back to the cloud computing model. All the account credentials are inside the cloud. There's an alias, a password, some other dynamic piece of data that I ask you every time you generate a transaction, send those in, and once they're behind the firewall, we'll execute a financial transaction as opposed to sending account data in the clear. That's the primary way that we do it. We've also got, you know, a mobile application of our 3D secure infrastructure, which is our internet security protocol. And then we have, because transactions go through the cloud, we have the ability to look at every single transaction in the context of every other transaction that's coming through and score them for risk and fraud and mitigate those risks in real time. So it's a big concern, but we have engineered, maybe over-engineered, our network to be able to be able to deal with. I mean, sort of, you talk about, you know, the mobile network operators always worry about bandwidth. I mean, we have a boatload of people who spend every single minute thinking about how to protect the next transaction that we drive through the system. So we got a lot of smart people working on that.
Okay, we got a few questions about AT&T that are service related. that's the price of
being, yeah. That's what Glenn gets for being the big guy in the room.
When you're exclusive, I guess that's. But I'll take this one, and maybe throw in a few follow-ups with the other questions, and try to do it in a relatively painless way. Here's this question that I get a lot too. If I buy a smartphone, why must I be tied into an exclusive service plan? Or if I modify my phone for another carrier, why do companies change the software? Did I ask that right? And isn't this monopolistic behavior? The funny thing about that question is somebody else asked about, don't AT&T and Verizon and T-Mobile have monopolies, which is kind of an interesting way of asking a monopoly question.
I forgot Sprint.
But I mean, people feel it this way because it feels like a personal monopoly on me. So can you explain from a business perspective why exclusivity is important?
Well, I can. It's really good. No. So let's look at it this way. So for those of you in the room, I imagine everybody here has a wireless device. How many of you with AT&T? I'm just kidding. No, I'm just kidding. I imagine you went out, and for those of you who have an iPhone, let's just go there. You went and bought an iPhone, and if you were a brand new 3GS customer, you paid, what, $200 for the device, correct? By paying $200 for that device, I can promise you the device costs a lot more than $200.
Like you paid like, what, 700?
So, I mean, just give you an example, there was a 3GS device that was unlocked that had come from another country that was just that was for sale on buy.com for $899. Okay, there was go on. So my point being is that the carriers, we're making an investment in every one of you. One of the reasons that you can get devices for the prices you do is because we subsidize those devices, whether us or one of our distribution partners. Doesn't necessarily answer the exclusive question, but what it tells you is if you want to go to, you know, we hear a lot, well, in Europe they don't do that. Well, in Europe they don't subsidize, but you pay full price for devices. Something tells me that our country and the adoption of mobility would be a bit different today than where it is if you were paying $800 for an iPhone, or if you were paying, you know, $600 for a Bold or $550 for a Storm. So part of what we do in the contractual world and the way that the business has been run for 20 years is we're willing to invest. You sign a 2-year contract, and then we live happily ever together, right? That's the goal. And you love your service, and we love you, and you get great devices. And then every X period of months, you can upgrade, and that's how it works. So that's one point. Let me talk about the exclusive side. The key to exclusivity is all around innovation. The fact that Apple and us, for example, decided to go into an exclusive relationship together was about us being able to do some things with them that hadn't been done before, and us both being able to, for lack of a better term, open the kimono and really be great partners and develop a partnership. If I know that the person sitting in my office is going to be in Kansas City at Sprint or in Basking Ridge at Verizon the next day, it makes it a little more difficult to really go out and innovate. Some of the things we did, we launched visual voicemail for the first time in the U.S. We did a whole bunch of different things that made that device a better device. That innovation is why exclusivity is so important. The facts are is that every one of the carriers aren't monopolies, but they all have their own set of exclusive things that they do. If you go outside of our wonderful world of mobility and you go outside of the wonderful world of communications and walk in any store you shop, they all have exclusives. For the same purpose, right? They're trying to compete, but they're also trying to bring innovation to those specific types of industries that they're in. So I don't know that you can say that there's 4 large carriers and there's obviously about 25 smaller carriers in the U.S. I don't think there's anybody talking about monopolies anytime soon inside of our businesses. But I think what you're finding in the industry is the way we've run this business for the last 20 years and the way it's adopted is why we've grown to where we are. You realize that we actually today have more innovation than any country in the world. Our smartphone.
And we certainly couldn't say that. A couple of years ago, everybody wanted to go move to Europe to get a cell phone.
Absolutely. Well, everybody wanted to move to Europe and or to Asia, and they're doing everything faster, bigger, better, smarter. Absolutely. And all of a sudden now, guess who's coming to visit us? I mean, he can tell you because he's on the network side. The U.S. has jumped in front on the innovation side in this industry, in this business. That ability for us to go invest. Another example, AT&T.
Well, before you go there, I got a question. And this is for, you know, you've seen the blogs. O'Malik is all over you. Arrington service. Now maybe it's just certain areas in Silicon Valley. I have a feeling on the peninsula, particular. I'm in downtown San Jose. My service is pretty good. But what can you tell us about when is the service getting a little better?
Sure. First of all, San Francisco is a really, really good market. We love San Francisco. Now, service is look, we're going to spend on our networks this year $18 billion, about $5.5 billion on the mobility networks. We're the largest spender of CapEx in the United States in any company. We're number one. Why are we investing? Because we want to have the best networks, whether that be wired or wireless. When you look at what we're going through now, one of the beautiful things we're experiencing, and we talked about this today, is we're having massive growth in data usage. Not just because of the iPhone, because of netbooks and laptops, and people want to be connected in ubiquitous service. So we're spending a lot of money, and we're pushing our partners to increase the level of innovation and technology faster than ever before because we're seeing the type of levels of usage that really no other carrier in the world is seeing at this particular time. Now let's talk about the Bay Area. We are doing something called an 850 overlay around the country. We're moving to 850 spectrum. And I'll let he can give you all the technical fun stuff on that. But what that really means is your service is going to get better. 850 propagates better than 1900. Right now, the Bay Area is going through that 850 overlay. When you do an 850 overlay, you touch everything in the network. So you touch every antenna, you touch every radio, you touch every switch, you touch every cell site. When you do that, things change. So in a lot of cases, you'll see where, you know, John, you didn't drop or you didn't have an issue, and then now you do. It's because we're going through and touching every aspect of the network.
Sorry, I got it. That's a good answer. Good answer. I think you got to a bunch of those issues. I've got like a stack full of questions here. I want to, and another one coming. Oh my goodness. I want to try to get some of the others. Thank you for that. A couple of questions that I've just run across are about mobile advertising. People in Silicon Valley care about advertising these days. AdMob is very big in it. What's the next big thing, Ali, in mobile advertising, besides AdMob?
Including AdMob.
How's that? Are you talking about companies or products?
No,
or
no.
Trends?
I think people are talking technologies and trends.
The things that we're interested in are new device platforms, so things like Android, the Palm Pre, the next version or flavor of the BlackBerry operating system. And I think to Peter's point earlier, I think we also agree that mobile devices in particular, because of sort of reliability issues and the expectation around speed and reliability, will probably be app-dominated, at least for the near term. And so sort of deeper integration into the app experience on devices from an advertising standpoint, integration, for example, of video or animation-based advertising ad units, I think will be a big sort of trend that we'll see in the next couple of years.
People are also asking questions about privacy. Mm-hmm. With mobile devices, there's a lot more knowledge about not just who you are, but where you are and what you're mm-hmm. doing. How's that going to play as advertising seems to be such a big piece of what's driving businesses in mobile right now?
So
maybe Tim can jump in on this too.
Yeah, sure. After you.
And Alan.
Privacy.
Everybody.
Privacy is obviously a very important, you know, aspect to our business. We don't store any personally identifiable information in our network or on our platform, so we don't actually know who is who in terms of who sees our ads. I think, you know, we will probably abide by whatever standard the industry sort of coalesces around, whether it's some kind of opt-in or other kinds of stuff around location specifically. But, you know, we don't store anything that's personally identifiable.
Right. So I think, you know, just to ladder on that, the applications that we've got that essentially take advertising to a direct marketing push, you know, to some extent a consumer that winds up with, you know, what would otherwise have been a circular or a mail coupon is actually resident on their device, and they can activate that automatically through the Visa network, very much go at that from a consumer permission standpoint. So to some extent, you know, we find that when consumers get a tremendous amount of value from discounts or promotions that they've asked to see and that they can turn off at any time, that's a huge value to them. And it's a huge value to advertisers because you can actually reach through the message to touch the people that it's relevant for who have asked to see it, and you can see who actually took action on it. But it absolutely comes down to asking the consumer, do you want this? Opt in for the service, opt in for categories, opt in for capabilities, which is the way we built the Android app and the way we're going to propagate that sort of services of offers and alerts and notifications. Location-based services all will be permission-based, and you can turn it off at any time.
Let me tweak the question a little bit as it goes to you, because there's another question here. What prevents advertisers from spending more money in the mobile market, and what needs to change? So as you talk about advertising and privacy, maybe also talk about
sure.
how the mobile market is developing and what's going to get people to spend more money there.
All right, three things. All right, well, first on the privacy thing, from a youth perspective, you know, you have to understand that, I mean, we are obviously in North America, opt-in, but from the on the youth side, they've grown up talking with anonymous environments, so there is the privacy to them has a completely different meaning. And I think you're even seeing this from an opportunity perspective with some of the new devices, some of the LG and Samsung, where your address book now is able to be a social network. Oh, there's an Android app, too, that takes your address book and turns it into a social network. You know, the idea that your Facebook friends, your Twitter friends are not necessarily your best friends or coming to a party or something that you're throwing, but your address book are where your real friends are. So from a advertising opportunity and privacy perspective, you're seeing that mesh in the address book becoming part of that social network equation. I think two things on the advertising side that it's going to take. Tim had mentioned some things in Asia in terms of sort of crowdsourcing, but on the shopping side, the social connected, that's where I think Visa has just an incredible opportunity too, is the social connected shopping. Mm-hmm. That is really going to, when the shopping becomes part of your social network, and then you layer on the location onto that, and of mm-hmm. course your Visa Go button and the other pieces, mm-hmm. that becomes very attractive for advertisers. So that's a great opportunity. I think the other piece that we were missing in digital out-of-home is answered for advertisers from the mobile perspective is what you saw in Europe and other areas where you had that real-time activation of advertising that we didn't have here, that mobile path, the short code on an advertisement. You know, there's Wikipedia, Locomotive has done some great things, and we use that platform as well, where you actually can take digital out-of-home and create an experience with that the consumer has right then and there. Mm-hmm. And then that goes on their Facebook page. It's also the old adage, you know, we here in North America, we were putting a URL on advertising and saying, okay, you see this billboard, now go home, get on your PC, and interact with that advertising. And so just very simple mobile paths on out-of-home, I think, are going to be a big thing. Mm-hmm. Just so you saw URLs in 99, 2000, that short code on the instant activation or real-time mm-hmm. activation for advertising is one of the big things that we're looking for.
Well, I think just to add to that, I think one of the things we're seeing from an advertising perspective as well is it's moving from, since mobile gives you the opportunity to target very tightly, again, if consumers tell you that you're allowed to, it's moving very much from here's a message to here's a service that you'd like. Oh, by the way, my message is in there, but I'm providing you a value. Or here's an opportunity to take advantage of a discount or an offer or something else that drives value to you, and my advertising message is a component of that, as opposed to just using this as another channel to sort of push a message to consumers. So I think we're seeing that, you know, Starbucks locator, you know, store locator. There's an implied commerce component in providing you an opportunity to find the next place to go get your caffeine hit. And if that comes with, oh, by the way, get 10% off if you're in after 2 p.m. when we're trying to drive, you know, sort of off-peak traffic, that then becomes both an advertising message and a value to the consumer. It looks like that's the form it's going to take.
Yeah, and just add on to it, just real-time search, right? I mean, that's really the location component added into it. That's the real value of Twitter and many of these things, is that real-time search piece. And if we do that in a social network way, which mobile enables you to do now, that's a win-win all around.
We got a lot of good questions and more than we're going to be able to get to. But for this side, it's kind of a series of questions. There are a lot of questions for Glenn about the iPhone. They're not all about that. One of them is, what needs to change with rate plans in a world where we're all carrying multiple devices? How is AT&T looking at that? How will pay for stuff?
That's a very good question. So I, for those of you that recall when Family Talk was born a few years back, right? In your home, you may have had one device, and then the other parent gets a device and kids device, and we had people asking, saying, wait, we want a deal. We want, you know, we have three devices. I see a time, and we're actually looking at it right now, is that may be where we have to go on data. You know, if I do my job correctly, and you've got your smartphone, and you've got your e-reader, and you've got a SIM or two in your car, and a SIM or two in your camera, and I do it all right, you have 10 SIMs, you're not going to want to write 10 checks, right? You're going to want to have one relationship with AT&T. So we're going to have to go there. We're going to have to innovate around rate plans. In fact, we're doing a lot of talking to customers right now about what they want. What is the expectation? If you have a camera that can send a picture, how do you want to pay for that? Do you want to pay monthly? Probably not. You probably want to say, well, when I take a picture and send it, I'll pay you. How's that? That seems to make sense. That's where we have to go. So we are going to have to innovate not just around the device itself, but around the business model behind the device, around the business model with our third-party partners and how they monetize. And so really this whole ecosystem has to change for each device, which makes it really fun because we're kind of innovating around every aspect as we look at that specific device and how we want to launch it.
Aaron, what needs to change with the equipment and the technology to prepare for this world where there are so many more devices connected and there's all sorts of demand for video, for games, streaming, multimedia?
So
your daughter calling you?
Yeah, exactly. So let's think about it like this, right? Let us say we want to add another speaker to this panel now. Well, you're going to have to make some space. You need a chair. You need another mic, so on and so forth. That is very similar to what is happening in the network out there. Suddenly, we've got humongous traffic coming out there. We need to add more capacity. And adding more capacity to an existing site is easy. But when I have to add more capacity by putting on an additional mic, that is phenomenally difficult. Because, first of all, I have local regulations called zoning. I got to get permission to make sure that I can find a good site a good site from an out-of-propagation perspective that provides the right coverage so that people don't complain. Got to be able to find that first. When I find a good out-of-site, I got to be able to work with the local authorities to get permission to put the site there. Now, that is the simpler part. Once I put that site there, I've got to get a big fat pipe out to that site so that I can have thousands of users using that site, generating megabytes of data, all being catered by that site. Now, that is very, very different from getting a DSL connection into your home and putting a Wi-Fi access point at the end of that.
And that's
because you've
not
got three
as
people
easy as one would think it should be.
Yeah, so that in itself... That in itself is difficult.
So are we doomed? I mean, is this ever going to happen?
We're not doomed, right? So where we are, different carriers exploring different options on how to make that happen in the most cost-effective manner. Because at the end of the day, you can solve any problem if you put tons of money on it, but that doesn't necessarily pay off. You got to have an infrastructure that is sustainable over a long period of time. So some of the things are you can get dark fiber out to the sites. That takes a little bit of time. You've got to have right-of-way, et cetera. Or you can build a microwave network that is point-to-point, maybe mesh, so on and so forth. Lots of these things are under discussion. Some are under production now. And it'll pan out over the next 12 to 18 months. You're going to see a dramatic difference in how this bandwidth is delivered to the sites. And then you can talk about 7.2, you can talk about 21, you can talk about 25, whatever speeds you want to talk about. And then it'll be time for the devices to catch up again. But lots of things happening in this space now.
Do you feel good about that answer, Glenn?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Let me just add one thing. Arun hit it dead on. The applications and the usage is going right now faster than the networks can keep up, in a sense. The beauty of that is, like I said earlier, we happen to be the guinea pig, right? We're in the middle of this growth. We are driving more usage than any other carrier on the planet, and the speeds that we're growing, and our network partners, which Ericsson is one, we're learning and we're growing together. We are going to be so well positioned to continue that growth, to add these other devices, to add the speed, because that's what you're going to demand. Right? You're going to demand to be able to utilize that speed and do the things you want to do, like Arun talking to his daughter. So that is exactly what we are as a network provider and have to do. And that's why we're spending, as you said, we are throwing lots of money at it as well.
Question about business. Most of the discussion, someone has noted, has been about consumer. And it used to be that when we talked about technology adoption, it happened in offices first, but we've got this consumerization of IT and technology that's really happening right now. With all the stuff happening in mobile, can businesses adapt fast enough? How can we help them through the pain, someone asks. And I guess that means, can businesses adapt quickly enough to the new technology that's available, figuring out what to do about different kinds of platforms, probably what to allow or not allow within the firewall, allowed devices, that kind of thing?
I have an answer, at least from a sort of advertising perspective, monetization perspective. I think as each sort of progressive technology develops from the desktop or the mainframe to the desktop or the TV to the desktop to mobile, we are learning as industries go that transferability is a very important aspect of making those businesses grow much more quickly than the previous sort of generation or era grew. So if you look at, for example, just the growth of advertising dollars on mobile versus the web versus radio versus TV, it's progressively gotten much, much, much shorter in terms of the time it's taken for the industry to catch up and get big. And so from our perspective, making sure that we build tools that make it easy for businesses to either build applications or to convert the ads that they have running on television or on the desktop is critical to making that sort of success happen.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. The tools and toolkits, it's also on the business side. I mean, one of the, whether it's Procter & Gamble, whoever, the biggest problems that they've had has been listening and activating in terms of social network. They can listen, but how do you activate quick enough?
Wait, what does that mean?
Like with Tropicana, I guess, with the new packaging, that they were listening.
That was a bad idea, right?
They saw it, and it was coming out everywhere that no one liked the new packaging, thought it was generic.
Yeah.
And very quickly, they activated and change that packaging. Well, that's with mobile. I mean, that's a real time. I mean, that whole cycle. Mm-hmm. So the idea to give consumers, I think you're going to see much more focus on that tools and toolkits for consumers to the endorsed impression. You know, I'm at the store. I see something I like. I'm going to send it through to my stream on Facebook or wherever it is. You know, Nokia even has a Life Blog button. on their devices. You know, yeah. I'm going to do this in real time, and that experience with that brand, and the more that brands can become a part of that endorsed impression, I think Visa also has done a great, the Visa Go button and these type of things that you're doing to enable Visa to become a part of that more than the transaction. Mm-hmm. That's where, from a business perspective, there's such a great opportunity.
Can I hear somebody wanting to cut in over here? Hold on.
Yeah, let me say one thing about business that at least we have seen from our experience. There are two things there. First and foremost, what the IT departments are concerned about is security. They want to make sure that any data that is out there is secure. You are who you are when you connect to the company network. The second thing is you need a stable device. If it's a computing platform, you need that device to be stable because you're not going to replace that device every 12 months. You make a big investment in buying a good computing machine. So you need that machine to last connected to the network for a couple of years, maybe 3 years. One of the things that we are doing together with AT&T is going after PC OEMs, getting modules built into the computers, and getting those computers, when you open up that computer, to directly connect into the IT network. There's no two-factor authentication. There's no additional VPN, nothing of that sort. So today I can go to Sweden.
That doesn't sound secure. Hold on.
Well, I'll tell you why.
Okay.
Because there is a highly secure tunnel that is running between the operator network and the enterprise IT network. If you look at AT&T, for example, AT&T provides connectivity to multiple businesses already today. There is a pipe that is carrying all their email traffic. Well, that is secure, and you're relying on that. Well, let's put that mobile data, mobile computing devices, on that same pipe over a secure channel. And let's make it easier for people to actually start working instead of waiting and, you know, punching in all these codes to just get connected. So those are pretty simple things that you got to do just to get the convenience going. And then, of course, the applications have to start working in a seamless manner. But security and the availability of stable devices is very, very important.
I want to take a quick fork off and pull Peter into the discussion. We got a bunch of questions about video. You don't have to answer this one specifically, but I'll throw it out there. Maybe somebody will pick it up after you have your comments, just kind of on where you see video going. You spend a lot of time thinking about the space and watching what's going on out there. The actual question is, I already watch live TV 24/7 in high quality on my iPhone. When will U.S. television and cable channels start streaming live and direct from browsers using HTTP streaming? And they're wondering if AT&T will restrict bandwidth.
I'll let Peter go first.
Yeah, I mean, I want to know the same thing. You know, I mean, it's bizarre, right? You can watch an episode of something on YouTube until ABC gets around to telling them to take it down. So there's like, I mean, it's like the Google Voice app. Like, if you got it early enough, good for you. The other thing that's a small nightmare for mobile, some people are actually starting to put a lot of content online. Comedy Central is a perfectly good example, right? Every episode of Jon Stewart ever is there. And that would be a great time killer. It doesn't happen to work on, like, anybody's phone. Great. You know, YouTube has made this huge investment in a service-side infrastructure for how do you get this to all these devices and opened up an SDK and an API to do that so that almost every device can play YouTube. This is great, except that now the networks are at war with YouTube because, I mean, YouTube did a good job, so they have some power, and so then we should go somewhere else. And this is like this classic, how do you not get something to the consumer and make the world really complicated? And that's what's going on right now. I mean, everybody has their assets and their business models to protect, and it's reasonable at one level, but it's also incredibly complicated for reasons that don't entirely make sense. And so, you know, I think these guys have to kind of get comfortable with, you know, the infrastructure the way the world is today, not the infrastructure the way the world was 5 or 10 years ago when a lot of this stuff was put in place.
Restricting bandwidth.
Yeah. So bandwidth. I think Arun went through this real well, but let's talk about that for a second. So today we sell a $60 5-gig plan. And by the way, going back to the question asked earlier about business versus consumer, you know what's really driving this massive usage? It's not business. Okay, business folks are boring. Okay, it's the consumers, it's the youth, it's the social networking that we've been talking about that's driving this great growth. But what we do, our network is simply put a shared resource. We have, and we're spending dollars, we're improving capacity, but the key to that shared resource is that everybody gets fair right to use it. And if you have somebody out there 24/7, I want to know who this is.
It wasn't me.
In 24/7, you know, streaming video, you know, you are obviously being a bit of a hog. And if you're on a site where that you being that bit of a hog interrupts or hinders quality of service for everybody else, how do you all feel about that? It's a problem. So we are we have our rate plans. We manage our rate plans. We will continue to look at our rate structures. But there isn't a carrier in the world today who isn't nervous about bandwidth. Peter said it earlier. I'll say it again. So they're all nervous about bandwidth because, again, the amount of usage and the surge that's coming is unprecedented. We're seeing usage that is just phenomenal. We're keeping up with it. We're very proud of where we are. We're continuing to drive it. We're continuing to spend money on it, continuing to pound on our vendors to get smarter, better, faster. But at some point, obviously, you're going to have to look at what is the right thing to do, not only for the greater good, but also obviously to make sure that quality of service is good for everybody, not just the individuals that may be using, you know, too many gigabytes for their own good.
Okay, I want to do. We're pretty much out of time, but I want to do one more speed round thing. So I'm going to ask the question first, and then try to slip a question to Tim that's different, and then get everybody's answer. So you have a little bit of time to think about it.
The last speed round question will be.
What's your prediction, the big thing in 3 years that we'll be talking about in the mobile space that everybody should be getting ready for? And the question I'm going to slip to you, Tim, before everybody answers that, we're going to start with Alan, then come back down, is what is Visa doing in NFC, which I assume is near field communication, and why haven't, I'm going to slap another question, why haven't mobile payments really taken off in North America? So if you could kind of like condense an answer into like a minute before we go to the speed round.
We'll take a shot at that. So NFC, basically that means you've got a contactless chip inside a mobile device. We've created a global standard, and that's actually taking off in places where we have chip readers at merchants so that, you know, that chip inside your phone can actually do something other than just be a really cool, expensive thing for AT&T or their partners to add to the device. The reason why we haven't seen that take off in North America is because we have a really good established payment infrastructure that about everybody in this room has at least five or six pieces of, and it's called a little Magstripe with all the fraud and risk management capabilities built into the cloud. So to some extent, there's not a unique business problem we're solving with near-field communications devices in North America at present. There are some discrete marketplace opportunities, but building out that network effect is just going to take a little bit longer than it does, say, in places like Asia where we've already commercialized those services.
Excellent work.
All right.
Excellent work. Okay. Speed round. 3 years. Big thing. Alan.
I don't know. It will finally be time for LBS, and I think possibly in a I think that'll have to be it, right? We'll be
location-based services, right?
Centric, okay, when we talk about proximity.
Okay. Tim?
I get to answer too? Quite.
Yeah.
Quite cool. I think in 3 years, I mean, the big thing, at least from a financial services perspective, I think one of the big things of the next 3 years will be democratization of access for the vast majority of the population in the world who wouldn't otherwise have access to it through a mobile device, which I think is one of the really cool things that we're doing, that sort of commerce enablement, that currency of progress that essentially uses that device and gets a consumer into financial services where they would otherwise just be cash in their pocket.
Like that pharmacist in India you were talking about.
Absolutely like that.
Ali?
Well, I mean, I don't want to piss Glenn off, but I think data access on mobile devices will be effectively free.
Wow.
I had to say something inflammatory. This is too boring.
Glenn's going to be like, you're going to be paying twice as much.
No, I think more people will browse the web on a mobile device than on a desktop device. I think that'll be a big deal.
Yeah, I can believe that.
Yeah, 3 years from now, it's all mobile. It's just the way it is. It's the way it's going to be. We'll have the speed, as Arun said. We'll be going about 3 years from now. We'll be having LTE come into the marketplace. Everything you have that's a device of any type, shape, or form, your car, everything will be connected. And not only connected to the web, which people go there first, but connected to each other. The ability to take this device and then walk in your car and throw whatever you have on it on the screen in the car, et cetera, that's the future of taking all these devices connected and working together.
Arun?
I think it's about scale. Scale in three different dimensions. Scale in bandwidth and speed. That is going to be phenomenal. Glenn talked about LTE. HSPA still has plenty of bandwidth left in it as well. Both are going to be there, evolving, delivering multiple megabits per second. Scale in the form of devices and applications. We're going to see an explosion there, all different kinds of form factors. And there's going to be another scale thing, which is to make that explosion of devices happen, you got to have scaling down of the technology that goes inside here. That modem has to be miniaturized as much as possible. Mm-hmm. The power consumption has to be optimized so that you can embed it into as many devices as possible. Over the next 3 years, if I look at my roadmap, that's what I can see.
Peter.
Yeah, ideal in electrons versus protons. Software is kind of just delivered by these little tiny bits of stuff. I have a much more software-centric perspective. I think applications really do continue to drive things for a while. Innovation there is going to depend a lot on how the platforms evolve. Right now, the iPhone is the only place where there's interesting application work going on. Sorry, I mean, we're trying hard on other platforms, but right now, that's the place. And the real question 3 years from now, is that going to be where everything goes, or are some of these other vendors, like the guys up the street at Google, going to get things together well enough that applications exist across all of these things? And it's going to be a big difference. I sort of hope we get to a world where applications work together, just like websites work together today, right, where websites do what they do well, and when they need to do something else, they link to the Visa site, or they, you know, embed the AdMob, you know, ad supply data and so forth. Because right now we're not at that world. They're very monolithic, one app at a time, trying to do everything. And it doesn't actually scale very well, and it doesn't foster the kind of innovation that people are going to come to expect, I think. So.
Isn't that the, I mean, that's the promise of the cloud, right? I mean, we're going to have one application, we'll be able to develop one application finally, and it'll, that's it, right?
Yeah. Well, panelists, you've all been insightful and gracious. Everybody, please join me in thanking them.
I trust you enjoyed tonight's program of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Glenn Lurie, President, Emerging Devices Organization, AT&T, Alan Rambam, President, Mobile Behavior, Arun Bikshesvaran, Senior Vice President, Multimedia and Infrastructure Solutions, Ericsson, Peter Hoddy, CEO, Kinoma, Tim Attinger, Global Head of Product Development, Visa, Ali Diab, Vice President of Product Management, AdMob, John Fort, Senior Writer, Fortune, and all of you for joining us. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.